Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So the NBA in-season trade deadline normally is not all that dope. In fact, usually it's the opposite of dope. It's usually just a bunch of teams moving smaller parts around and focusing on salary cap issues rather than loading up a roster for the postseason. And for the majority of the lead-up to yesterday's 3 p.m. Eastern deadline, that's exactly what that was. I mean, sure, there was that four-team trade earlier in the week and the Andre Iguodala trade that was actually pretty cool. And given that nobody in the East other than Milwaukee really seems to matter, it was somewhat interesting. But other than that, there was not a hell of a lot going on. And then, in the final hours, before the deadline, it went from zero to Shakira. It went from zero to this. Zero to this. The Pistons send Andre Drummond to Cleveland for, well, let's be honest, almost nothing. Brandon Knight, John Henson, and a second-round pick in 2023. If that doesn't tell you how rough the market was for Drummond, I don't know what does. And he himself did not take it very well, which I'll get to a little bit later on. Minnesota trades Andrew Wiggins to Golden State for D'Angelo Russell. Now, that was a significant enough deal that that's going to get its own take a little bit later on. T-Wolves also jumped into the Miami-Memphis trade, and they made a three-team deal. The Hawks and Blazers made a trade. The Hawks and Clippers made a trade. Houston and Memphis made a trade. Philadelphia and Orlando made a trade. Washington and Denver, sure, why the hell not? And of course, the most significant deal of the day was that three-team deal between the Clippers, the Knicks, and the Wizards that resulted in Marcus Morris and Isaiah Thomas going to the Clippers. The Knicks get Mo Harkless, the rights to a Ukrainian point guard, and the Clippers' first-round pick this year, and the right to a pick swap next year, and the Clippers' second-round pick next year, and the Wizards get Jerome Robinson. So when it all shakes out, that is an enormous move by the Clippers and a gut punch for the Lakers. Because as much as Iggy going to the Heat was a tie for the Clippers and Lakers, because neither team got him, yesterday was a clear win for the Clippers. I love that move for the Clippers. Like, they got the guy that both teams were trying to get. Both teams wanted him, and both teams wanted him to keep him away from the other guy. So the Clippers get over, which is huge for them.
Huge.
Wow, Alvy. Way to go, Alvy. It seemed like a foregone conclusion that Morris was going to end up playing in Staples. It was just a matter of which jersey he was going to wear. And that question seemed to come down to whether or not the Lakers would be willing to give up Kyle Kuzma, or the Clippers would be willing to give up Landry Shamet. And the answer to both was no. The Lakers were not willing to give up Kuzma, and the Clippers did not have to give up Shamet. So the Clippers get Morris because they had picks that they could offer and the Lakers didn't. And because, according to Ramona Shelbourne, the Knicks didn't just want Kuzma, they wanted Danny Green and a second-round pick, too. Now, if that really was the price, if that really was what the Knicks were trying to get from the Lakers, that's a really big ask. Like, if that were the case, I understand the Lakers walking. But damn, it's got to sting. It's got to sting that the Clippers get this guy. Like, if all the Clippers did was make that move to make sure that the Lakers didn't get Morris, that's a big win in and of itself. But actually getting Morris is a bigger win because of what he can do for them. They get a guy who's averaging more than 19 per game. They get a guy who's hitting on more than 44% from deep. They get a guy who's tough as hell, and they get a guy that can guard the five. And on paper, it's a really nice fit. The Clippers just got better, and they got more versatile, and they got that much tougher to stop in the fourth quarter of playoff games because they can throw so many different looks at you. They can go Pat Beverly, Lou Williams, Kawhi, PG, and Morris, and space the hell out of the floor without giving up that much defensively. And it's the kind of lineup that can cause some serious problems for the Lakers come playoff time. If they want to go big, they can go big. If they want to be more versatile, they can do that too. And they can spend the rest of the regular season experimenting with how it feels to have Morris on the bench, or I should say on the floor, with Kawhi and PG on the bench. And they get all of that without having to give up Landry Shamet. Another killer move from a Clippers front office that is stacking killer moves. So where does that leave the Lakers? And you get the sense, I love that move for the Clippers, but where does that leave the Lakers? Let me read the first part of this Mark Stein tweet. Quote, the Lakers are expected to give free agent guard J.R. Smith a post-trade deadline audition, perhaps as soon as next week. End quote. That's the first part of that tweet. Let me give you the first part of my reaction. That is so right. J.R. Swish. Back in the league. J.R. Swish. In a Laker gamer. That really is so right. Bring that on. Listen, I don't know if that really helps them at all. Honestly, I don't know if that helps them at all, but I know this. It helps me a lot. Like, I don't know if the Lakers win with JR. I just know that JR wins with JR. Jim Rome, that is. You know me, I never want to make it about me. But let's go ahead and make it about me. If missing on Marcus Morris means getting soup-throwing JR Smith, then I'm all about it. Because it is so right. Do I not have a beautiful singing voice? The rest of that tweet from Stein included the detail that the Lakers, quote, remain favorites to sign Darren Collison if Collison elects to make a comeback to the NBA, in addition to potential pickups on the buyout market. I love these guys trying to get guys to come out of retirement. Collison actually makes sense. You know, Darren Collison, the pride of Rancho Kook. The pride of UCLA. And guess who just so happened to be sitting courtside right near Jeannie Buss last night at Staples? Darren Collison. Right? And the crowd went crazy when Darren Collison was showing up on the big screen. Of course, he did tell Dave McManaman, you should not read anything into him showing up at a Laker game hours after the trade deadline. And with rumors about him coming to the Lakers, quote, just watching the game, ain't nothing to it, got the best seats in the house, end quote. Yeah, nice try with that, Darren. I get that you're a SoCal guy and you're just watching a basketball game, but I guarantee you Laker fans are reading everything into it. They're photoshopping jerseys right now. They're probably printing them up too. They have to, because yesterday was rough. The Lakers lost to the Rockets on the court. And by the way, how pissed are you if you hit the Lakers last night? Thinking that they'd hit the floor with something to prove after the Clippers made that deal. Hit the floor with something to prove and the Rockets would have no chance playing their miniature ball. So how pissed would you be if you hit the Rockets? Or I should say the Lakers last night. And no. I am not speaking from personal experience. See, I don't ever want you to think that I do that sort of thing and that would color my takes, because they don't. It doesn't. I am not speaking from personal experience. I'm speaking from James Kelly's personal experience. You know he at that. Lakers get worked by the Rockets on the floor and worked by the Clippers off the floor, and James Kelly got worked because of it, allegedly.
That's right.
Lakers have the best record in the West, but the Clippers keep getting over on them. The Lakers have the best record in the West, but to me, the Clippers are now officially the team to beat in the association. Am I right, Big Head? Don't act like you didn't hit them at plus 300 to win the championship, Big Head. I know you did.
That's right.
Lakers ain't gonna be, or Clippers ain't gonna be little brother much longer.
Brother.
It's a good day for them. I love what the Clippers did.
Pretty damn cool.
Big B. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, don't make a shake. Do not eat a bar. Grab for a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender, made from real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It goes with you wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere at all. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Calais Campbell is my guest. Calais, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Oh, man, life is a dream, baby. Living it up.
That is great. Calais, you had quite a week last week, starting with the Pro Bowl. You won the defensive MVP, and then you received the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award. Can you take me back a little bit? Because, you know, the old cliche that it's just an honor even to be nominated. So what did it mean to you just to be nominated for the award?
I mean, it was awesome. You know, I mean, I told all my family and friends that, like, I'm cool just being nominated because – they made the award so prestigious. It gives you so much exposure to do more. You know, I mean, everybody who was nominated was worthy to win it, and because we do a lot of good stuff in the communities, and it's great to see because so many other guys want to win it, want to be nominated, and so it's very motivational.
All right, so if it's that great just to be nominated, what kind of emotions run through you when you find out that you won the award?
Oh, man. I couldn't really express how I felt because, like, in that moment, it was just like, man, this is a big deal. Like, this is the most prestige award in all of sport. And so for me to be able to win this, that was really cool. But I have to say it takes a whole team. You know, I mean, I have a lot of people who are very deserving and that helped me along the way.
Calais Campbell joining us. So when you got up on stage, you talked about Ryan Mullaney, who was your high school football coach back in Colorado. He was actually with the Bears back in the day. What did he learn about Walter Payton, and what did he tell you about Walter Payton?
Oh, yeah, man. He used to get on me all the time. The things he used to always say was that first things first was he's the hardest working person on the field. I mean, after practice was over, he went and did extra work, you know, doing goalpost touches, sprints. I mean, he's always doing extra work. And then he said, like, the way he carried himself in the locker room, he always was the nicest person, humble person. Treat everybody the same, whether it's the janitor or the owner of the team. No matter who you were, he would treat you with respect. And I think he just wanted me to have that kind of role model because it's easy when you're a kid looking into the NFL, looking to these places to find role models. They're not always, that have character and integrity. So he wanted to make sure that I followed the right people.
Calais Campbell joining us. He is the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year winner. So now you've played, Calais, with Kurt Warner, Anquan Boldin, and Larry Fitzgerald, all of whom won the Walter Payton Award. What did you learn from them, and what's it mean to you to be joining them in receiving that prestigious award?
It's huge. You know, I mean, those guys paved the way. You know, when you're a young guy coming into the league, you know, you want to, you know, you just pay attention. You open your eyes, you look around and see who's doing things that you want to do. And, you know, I was lucky enough to sit next to Kurt Warner my first year on the plane rides when we went to away trips. He was kind of, let me sit with him because, you know, they have all the rookies in the back all three to a row. And just being 6'8", it wasn't working for me. So I went up to aisle trying to find some place to sit down. And Kurt had an open seat next to him, and he let me sit down with him. And that was great because, just those conversations we'll have in between his study and breaks. And the knowledge he dropped on me was very, very beneficial to my career. And, I mean, you go down the list, though, of guys who've really left their print on me. You know, I obviously you are who you surround yourself with. You are who the people that, that you spend time with. So I've learned from some top-quality people.
We're talking to Calais Campbell. Let me ask you this. I mean, you've had a great, great career. You put up huge numbers on the field. But if that's all you did and you never try to make an impact off of the field, do you feel like you would have missed out?
Yeah, I'd have been a failure. You know, I mean, I don't care if I became a Hall of Fame football player, but I never did anything off the field. And, my career wasn't good enough. I mean, this platform the NFL gives you, you know, it'd have been in vain. You know, and that's something I was raised, you know, to be involved in the community and to, you know, help my neighbor. I mean, we as human beings are naturally, we're meant to be with other people. You know, we're meant to help other people, and it takes a village. So, you know, being given the responsibility of being in the NFL, you have your natural role model, and I take that with great pride.
Calais, your journey really is something, and it certainly has been challenging. As many people know, for a period of time, you and your family lived in a homeless shelter. What did you learn about yourself and about life during that time?
Well, I can handle anything, that's for sure. You know, right. The right people. You know, I mean, my family, you know, my dad did a really good job understanding, like making, helping us understand that this is a temporary situation and we will be just fine. You know, just, you know, stay the course, stay together, and we'll be just fine. And by the time we were in high school, we lived in a 5-bedroom house, and it was awesome.
And he was right. You know, I'm glad you mentioned your father, Charles. You and I have talked about him in the past. He passed away when you were 17. You talked about him in your speech on Saturday night. You and your siblings and your mother founded the CRC Foundation in your father's honor. So what's it mean to you to know that the work that you have done in his name is being honored like this?
I mean, it's everything. You know, I mean, you know, you want people to know what he stood for. You know, I mean, that's the whole reason we started it, was to help people in his honor. So people knew who he was, you know, what he stood for, because, you know, I think he was an incredible person. And, you know, I think on that stage, you know, or everybody hearing his name, you know, I think that's pretty cool. But, you know, I mean, he wouldn't even care. You know, he's just all about, like, just what we do in the community and the amount of people we help. And that's what makes him special. That's what makes him worthy.
You know, Clayus, what did he stand for? For instance, that foundation was originally founded to pass on some of the things that you learned from your father. You know, what are the lessons and ideas that you're looking to pass to kids through your foundation? In other words, what were the types of things that he did stand for?
Oh, man. Integrity, character, always, you know, doing things the right way, never cutting corners, you know, being the hardest working person at whatever you're doing, having a standard to yourself. I mean, these things that establish confidence, which in turn allows you to accomplish goals, you know, and I mean, it's just, you know, preparation is the only way to really be, you know, to be confident in something. And then after that, it's past successes. But, you know, it's really that only time you really fail at something is when you quit and continue to go and go and go. And just, I mean, you know, never believe that you're out of it, you know, because you never are. I mean, you can go down a list of things that he taught me that were just, I mean, you know, from making good decisions and everything as a consequence. And, I mean, there are countless things that I try to instill in these young kids when I talk to them, because I know that, you know, each kid has great potential. And if I can just say something that's going to motivate them, that's going to have them focus a little bit harder on their schoolwork, be a little more disciplined in what they want to do in life and their goals, you know, then it's worth it. So, you know, I dedicate a lot of time and hours to being around kids and having those one-on-one conversations and really trying to be the best role model I can be, the same way my dad was for me.
Clayus Campbell joining me for a few more moments, which is great because that brings me to my next point. There's also a story that when you were 8, you met Terrell Davis. What do you remember about that? And then how much does that inspire you to meet kids yourself and have a similar impact?
Very much inspires me, because I know how that moment for him was probably 5 minutes, but for me, it's a lifetime. And, you know, he represented, you know, the NFL at a high level, but he also made me believe that, like, you know, it's just hard work. You know, it's not like you have to be anything, you know, you don't have to be like some mythical character. You don't have to be some kind of god. You just have to be a guy who works hard. You know, I mean, you have to have natural talents, you know, sure, but, you know, it's really a guy who works hard, who's going to do everything the right way. And that was huge for me to see, like, this guy who I idolized and had on this pedestal of being some, you know, mythological character. And, you know, it's like, oh, he looks like my dad, you know, and that was huge. And I try to, you know, make it real for people when I get around players, just or kids that want to play sports, and just kids, period. And it's just like, you know, if I could just inspire them and, you know, and keep them from, you know, just on a level of, you know, like, the only formula is hard work. You know, there's no other formula. And I think that's one of the best things you can have. You know, and I was lucky enough to meet Troy Davis again at 14, which is just as beneficial, especially to my football career.
Clayus Campbell joining us. Now, as I mentioned, being presented with the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award was something, but it capped off a week where you were also named the defensive MVP of the Pro Bowl. What was your Pro Bowl experience like this year?
Oh, man. The Pro Bowl is always fun, you know. I mean, all the family comes out. You know, it's kind of like a family reunion. You know, got all that, you know, my big family. You know, we all get together, and it's a great time. And all my brothers get to hang out with all the superstar players who they have respect for and admiration. But this year, playing in the game was very tough because, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I grew up a real big Kobe fan, and he was so inspirational to me as well through, like, just, you know, studying. I always study greatness. That's one thing I take pride in, studying greatness. So I spent a lot of hours studying Kobe. And, you know, and that one hit me hard right before the game. But it also made me kind of embrace every moment. And, you know, I don't usually play as hard as I can in the Pro Bowl. Not that I played as hard as I could this time, but I've definitely played a lot harder this time around. And I think a lot of guys did, though. And I think that was just because, you never know when your life's up. So you gotta embrace every moment. And, you know, it was definitely a fun experience, but definitely it was eye opening. Just like, man, take every moment and make it special.
No, I appreciate your thoughts on that. You know, as a quick follow up, did you ever spend time with Kobe? And as somebody, like, as you point out, preparation breeds confidence. You want to work really hard. I mean, that is the separation to a certain extent. But what made him so different? If most guys really want it badly and really want to work hard and are willing to pay that price, what separated him from everybody else in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just to the level. You know, I mean, it's easy to say you want it badly, you know, but it's a whole other thing to put the work in over and over and over again. I mean, I think everybody who's successful in sport or successful anywhere, that they understand that it's really hard work that gets you there. You know, I'm sure you get to where you're at right now. You put a lot of time and effort, you know, practicing to getting where you're at. And that's a testament to you and anybody who's successful. But I think that there was definitely a difference between Kobe Bryant and a lot of other people by the way he worked. You know, I mean, it's one thing to work hard. It's another thing to, you know, dedicate yourself to the craft to a level where you want to be better than everybody else. And I think that's super special. And I did get a chance to meet him. And the aura around him and the way he carried himself, you know, and just how, I mean, he was just, he wanted to, like, you know, hear your story. You know, he wanted to know about me and, you know, what drove me. And I was just like, man, like, leaving that time hanging with him, it was just like, man, that's special. You know, this is Kobe Bryant. You know, this is how it's supposed to be done.
I'm not surprised by that at all. I guarantee, number one, I guarantee he knew your deal. He knew who you were and what you were about. And I'm sure he wanted to hear about you and what made you great. Really quickly, Klass, the team announced earlier this week that it'll be the first team to play back-to-back games in London next season. You are no stranger to London. What was your reaction to that news?
You know, I mean, it's football. You know, you put me anywhere, let me go play the game of love. I'm going to do it the best I can. If it's back-to-back weeks, we're going to be out there for a week, you know, just making sure that, you know, I bring all the things I need necessary to go out there and play. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, people who make decisions that are best for the team overall. And my job is to make sure everybody else gets on board and we do the best we can.
He's going to lead from the front. Klass Campbell, 3-time All-Pro, 5-time Pro Bowler, co-founder of the CRC Foundation. He was named the NFL's Walter Payton Man of the Year on Saturday and was the defensive MVP of the Pro Bowl. Klass, I appreciate you. Congrats on that great, great honor, and always good to have you on the show. I appreciate it so much.
Always good talking to you, man.
Michigan beat Nebraska 79-68 Tuesday night. That snapped a 4-game losing streak. And they did so without a couple of their starters, including senior captain Xavier Simpson, who was leading the nation in assists per game at that time. He was serving a suspension for violating team rules. We didn't know what that was. Now, the Cornhuskers have been having a rough season, but Michigan going out on the road to win like that and snap that losing streak while they were shorthanded was still pretty impressive. Turns out the reason why Simpson was suspended was also pretty impressive. Let me read you the first sentence of this article. Quote, Xavier Simpson's 1-game suspension last month came after he wrecked a car that belongs to athletic director Ward Manuel's wife, according to a police report obtained by the Ann Arbor News M Live. Uh-oh! Wrecking a car is one thing. Wrecking a car that does not belong to you is another. Wrecking a car that belongs to the AD's wife is even worse. And then the next sentence is not much better. Quote, the report also shows that the University of Michigan basketball star lied to officers about his name and whether he was driving when the vehicle crashed into a utility pole in Ann Arbor hours after Michigan's loss to Illinois last month, according to the police report. End quote. Xavier, Z-Man, man, what are you doing? Come on, Xavier. You cannot lie about your name, allegedly, and then lie about whether or not you were driving a car that smashed into a utility pole. The report says that the police found Simpson near the vehicle that had collided with a utility pole and a street sign. Let me now go back to the report from the Ann Arbor News / M Live for the next sentence because it is pretty awesome. And I quote, Simpson initially told officers his name was Jeff Jackson Simpson and that he was walking down South Forest Avenue when he noticed the crashed vehicle. Ann Arbor police said that in the report acquired via Freedom of Information Act request, end quote. Jeff Jackson Simpson. My man told the authorities his name was Jeff Jackson Simpson. You can tell my laugh. I still have some of that bronchitis going. Anyway. That's what you came up with, Xavier. Spur of the moment. Jeff Jackson Simpson. Dude, Evan Fields and Ron Mexico think that Jeff Jackson Simpson is a horrible alias.
Jackson?
Ron Mexico can't believe you went with that. Evan Fields cannot believe you went there. Jeff Jackson Simpson? Hey, why stop at three names? Why not Jeff Jackson, Simpson, Johnson, Stevens, Smith, the fourth. That'd be like me wrapping my car around a telephone pole, and then the authorities coming up, yo, Jim Rome, right? No. You're Jim Rome, right? No. Sir, we know you. You've been on TV. You've got that stupid goatee. We know you. Jim Rome, right? No. Oh, really? What's your name? Mark David Rome. Excuse me? What is your name? Oh, my name. You're asking for my name. It's Jeff. Yep, Jeff Jackson Simpson. Yep, that's me, Jeff Jackson Simpson. But my friends, they call me JJ or JJS. Whatever's best for you authorities. Whatever's best for you officers. JJS, JJS. And yep, I was just walking right down the street and I happened upon this rig that was wrapped around a utility pole. Crazy, right? And I said to myself, Jeff Jackson Simpson, because that is my name. I said to myself, damn, Jeff Jackson Simpson, that is a crazy car crash. I hope the person who is driving it is okay. I said to myself, Jeff Jackson Simpson? Jeff Jackson Simpson thinks they must have needed the jaws of life to get that cat out of that rig. Like, I'm not sure what's better here. The horrible alias that he gave or the fact that he actually told the cops he just happened to be walking right down the street right after it happened. And I say that because it happened or this happened or they saw him at 3 a.m., That's right. Jeff Jackson Simpson was walking right by at 3 o'clock in the morning. My man Jeff Jackson Simpson is acting like he's just out for a nightly stroll at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yep, couldn't sleep. Get some of my best ideas at 3 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, I'm sure that you officers are really busy investigating this mysterious accident, so I'm just going to be on my way. You know, doing my usual stroll at 3 a.m. Love to get a little fresh air in the middle of the night. You know, a little fresh air a couple hours before sunrise. According to the report, they weren't buying it because they knew who he was. They recognized him as the senior captain and point guard of the local basketball team. Yeah, wait a minute. Aren't you Xavier Simpson, point guard for Michigan? Second team all-conference last year. Me? Oh, no. No. I'm Jeff Jackson Simpson. I get that a lot, though. People say I look like Xavier Simpson. I've never heard of that cat, though. Must be a really good-looking guy. Am I right, officers? Anyway, again, I'm just going to be on my way and finish off my middle-of-the-night stroll. Y'all have a good evening. Of course, that didn't work. He told the officers he lied. He told them he lied about his name because he did not want to be named in the crash report. Yeah, I get that, JJ. I get that, Jeff Jackson. I really do. Nobody wants to be named in a crash report, Jeff Jackson. JJ, nobody wants that. Especially if you were the one, JJ, who crashed somebody else's car in the middle of the night. Let me help you out with something, though, JJ. Let me tell you exactly how this works, Jeff Jackson. If you crash a car, you get named in the report. That's how that works. Simpson said the car belonged to Evan Manuel, a manager on the basketball team and the son of the AD. Manuel and Jeff Jackson live in the same building. Jeff Jackson apparently had been given permission to borrow that car that night. The car is registered to Evan's mom. She was notified about the accident, and the car was towed away. When JJ was interviewed the next day, he told authorities he lost control of the car in icy conditions and slammed into the pole. According to the report, police did not notice the smell of intoxicants on JJ, and he was cited for driving too fast under the conditions. In other words, nobody other than the utility pole got hurt. Nobody was hurt. It does not sound like it was that big of a deal. And it wouldn't even be a story if Xavier Simpson, driver of the car in the accident, had not said that he was Jeff Jackson Simpson and pretended to be a 3 a.m. ped who saw the accident and was just walking right on by. So once again, I can't believe I got to do this yet again, but let this be a lesson to everybody. If you do something, own it. I've been saying this since I got on the air. Be accountable, be responsible. If you do something, own it. Not owning it makes it so much worse. I'd say that I'm going to say this one more time and one more time only, but I won't, because someone else is going to mess this up. Somebody else would jack it up and I'll have to say it again. But let me say it again for the last time today. The cover-up is always worse than the crime, JJ. The cover-up is always worse than the crime, this time included, especially this time. Because if Jeff Jackson does not try to cover it up, we're not talking about it, and he's not suspended. And if you really do have to cover it up and come up with an alias, you sure as hell better come up with something better than Jeff Jackson Simpson. So nearly everybody I know has trouble sleeping. Do you fit into that category? Probably so. Are racing thoughts overtaking your night of sleep? Are you tired of not being able to sleep? Do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? If so, it is time for you to try Ebb. If you have tried everything from pills to pillows with little success, it is time for you to try Ebb. Ebb is the first and only wearable, drug-free solution that targets the root cause of sleeplessness, the racing thoughts. Ebb applies precise and continuous cooling to the forehead, which calms your mind, and it's clinically validated. 4 out of 5 users report falling asleep faster and improving overall sleep quality. Ebb allows people suffering from sleeplessness to drift more comfortably into a deeper, more restorative sleep. Ebb Sleep is designed to work with your natural sleep-wake rhythms to allow you to get into a deep sleep much more quickly. Listen, this is a real issue. Many people I know have trouble sleeping. You want to have the energy to do the things that you love to do again. If so, you need to get the sleep in order to do those things. Ebb's natural solution has no morning side effects and allows you to get right back to your peak performance. Have the energy to do the things you love once again by getting the sleep you need. Right now, you can try Ebb risk-free for 60 nights to confirm that it's the solution you have been looking for. Go to tryebb.com/Rome. That's TRYEBB.com/Rome. Tryebb.com/Rome. Order today. Get the sleep that you need and that you deserve. Derek Noddy is my guest. Derek, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Doing pretty well. How about you?
Good, good. Derek, there's a lot that I want to talk to you about, but let me start right here. For the rest of your life, you will be introduced as a Super Bowl champion. What have the first few days as a champ been like for you?
Honestly, it's been for a lot of celebrations. Not much sleep, but a lot of great times with my friends and teammates.
Derek, there's this awesome photo of you doing a snow angel and the confetti on the field after the game. You know, given that you spent your entire life working for that very moment, what kind of emotions were running through you in that moment?
Man, it was a lot. It was just the first time me being a champion ever in my life, man. And it was a lot for me to take in. There was a point through all that celebration. I caught myself crying. I'm like, yo, I'm really a champion after all the stuff I had to do, all the stuff from middle school, high school, college, all the stuff I had to sacrifice, all the stuff I had to put in to get to this point right now. And to say I'm a champion is just an ultimate blessing.
Derek Nnadi joining us. You know, I wonder, too, in that moment, like maybe it hit you even harder than you thought it would and you found yourself crying. I wonder how long it takes for something like that to sink in. Like, do you feel like it already has, or do you think it's going to take even longer?
Oh, no. I realized that, like, the championship feeling in me hit me about 30 seconds left in the clock.
And then you knew. So what did that feel like? Did it feel the way you thought it would feel?
I didn't know. I was thinking about it the day before, the night before. I was trying to figure out how it would really feel. We had a minute left in the game. I really want to say it was over, but I've seen this type of story happen so many times. Things would switch up in a blink of an eye. I can still remember myself telling out, "We got a minute 12 left. It's not over yet. We got a minute 12 left." And then when it hit that 30-second mark, at that point, I threw my helmet off. It's on my feet. I'm running up and down the sideline. I'm like, yo, we really won. We really won. It was just an amazing story, honestly.
Chiefs defensive tackle Derek Nnadi joining us. I want to talk more about that game in a minute, but you made national headlines this week when it was announced that you were going to cover the adoption fees for all of the dogs at the KC Pet Project. I know you've had a relationship with them throughout the season. How did you first get involved with them?
Before I got into the regular season for this second year, I wanted to do something last year, but I didn't have the time for it, just being my rookie year, trying to get used to that and stuff and everything like that. Going forward in my second year, I want to do something in the community with all the animals, you know, anybody who has things of ideas. I was reaching out for things of ideas, and the KC Pet Project came across that table. And when we got that connection with them, the idea came on that every time we would win a game, I would cover the adoption fees for one dog. And then when it spread to the Super Bowl, I wanted to change it up. I said, you know what, if we win the Super Bowl, I want to cover the adoption fees for all the dogs they have in there. And it was literally just a last-second idea. And it was just, I just wanted to do it just to help out any type of way.
Derek Nnadi joining us. Now, you've got two dogs of your own. The first is a pit bull named Rocky. Get Rocky, and what was he like when you first got him? Was he scared?
Yes. I got Rocky my junior year going into my senior year. And when I first got him, he was just very scared, very timid. Literally everything scared him. If I dropped a water bottle, he would freak out just right in his cage and not want to be bothered for like minutes on end. But with him, I had to really just take it slow with him. So I had to take him everywhere I went and let him introduce him to new people, new animals, new dogs, different sounds, different surroundings, just to let him get used to it. And with him, it was kind of like baby steps because, like, if you go too past the boundary, he's got to go back to square one. So, like, him, it was a big project, honestly. And honestly, like, all that time, if you look on now, you will never believe you went through all that.
I was going to say, so, like, what's he like right now? Is he relaxed? How much has he grown since then?
Besides, you know, getting diesel, he's just really just chill, honestly. He will approach people, sniff them, he'll approach other dogs, I'll play with them. It's like night and day with him.
Now, you've got a second dog, Saint. What is Saint like, and how well do the two of them get along?
Oh, my goodness. See, Saint is a ball of fire, and I'm low-key, I'm disappointed myself because I know I'm good with names. Saint, he's a good dog. He just has too much energy, man. Like, let's say I wake up at 6:30 in the morning. He's ready to go 6:30 in the morning, tail wagging, jumping, rolling. It's just like, it's just him. It's just, you guys take yourself with him. And when I first introduced Saint to Rocky, they kind of hit it off as soon as we got into the house. And usually they're playing around with each other, just having a ball. Like, anytime they're in the house, they're just playing with each other nonstop. Literally, like, it gets to a point sometimes I got to tell them to calm down or they just drop while they're playing. You know? So I, like, give them time out just to chill. But, yeah, those two are just peas in the pod. They're just the best of friends.
That's awesome. Derek Dottie joining us. And then Rachel Ray announced that she was so inspired by you that she was going to sponsor food for the dogs. And then a few hours ago, the KC Pet Project posted a photo of empty kennels with the news that because of your support, all of the dogs have been adopted at the adoption center. What does it mean to you to hear that?
You know, when I first heard the news, I was like, okay, yeah, that's a job well done. It's amazing. It's really magical. Like, all those dogs are in there. Who knows how long they're in there, and now they're finally in the forever homes with families that are going to love and cherish them. It's really amazing. Like who knows what their story was before they got into that home and that shelter, and now they're in a family who's really going to love them, support them, make sure they're well-fed, have children to play with. It's amazing, man.
That is a job well done. Derek Nottie joining us. All right, so really quickly back to the game itself, and really good work by you with the other. In the second and third quarter, the 49ers, their offense seemed to be having success, and then in the fourth quarter, you guys completely shut them down. What changed for you and the defense in the fourth quarter?
I want to say we buckled down because, you know, with our team, we've been through a lot of adversity, especially in the playoffs. We always had a trail. We had to come back from a big deficit. One of the biggest things we do, we don't blame anybody. We just stick to the task at hand and focus on what we have to do. And no one was freaking out. We're just, all right, what we got to do now? We're going to make some corrections. We got to get it done. And we're going to come out a winner. And that's what we did.
And then as you guys stepped up, your offense came alive as well. It seems like throughout the playoff run and really throughout the season, both sides of the ball really seem to feed off of each other. As a defense, how fired up do you get when Patrick Mahomes and the offense start clicking and firing on all cylinders?
That's just a given, man. With Patrick and all the weapons he has on the opposite side, they just need the opportunity. That's all it is. And to go back to the offensive defense going back and forth, going back to the beginning of the year, as, you know, everyone could see, our defense was kind of struggling. Everybody's running the ball like it's nobody's business on our defense. And it really took a while for us to really just come together and say, you know what, you can't keep relying on the offense to save us game in, game out. So we really had to buckle down and say, you know what, we got to carry our load and carry our burden. We gotta be the ones to save the team if it goes in our favor. We gotta be the ones to save the team with our defense. And going and doing it for years and week after week after week, we can show that not many teams can run the ball against us. We're very efficient and pass rushing, especially with our guys Frank Clark, Chris Jones, our guys from back end, Kendall Fuller, Tyron Matthew, as well as Juan Thornhill. Overall, we're having a really, really dominant defense, and they showed it throughout the playoffs as well as half of the rest of the regular season as well as the Super Bowl.
Derek Nottie, the Chiefs, joining me for another moment or so. You know, when I said to you at the very top, what was that moment like when you realized that you were going to win it all? And you said, you know, I cried and it all kind of hit me. Part of that is because of what you went through and how hard you had to work. You played your college ball at Florida State, which meant that you were playing for the legendary Odell Higgins. Now, this guy is not going to make life easy for guys. What was it like when you first met him? And then what was it like to play for him? How tough was he on you initially?
Oh, my. See, it's funny you say that. That man, I really felt like that man hated me. Like, while he was recruiting me, he seemed so cool. And then when I finally touched down to Tallahassee, he was like, oh, man. I'm in jail. Like, why is that so hard on me? Like, every time I do something right, I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm right, I'm wrong. So it was like, even after that, like, I felt like I was just trapped. Like, I would have nightmares. I could hear him yelling at me in my dreams. It was bad. But, like, at the end of the day, it took me maybe about 2 years to really kick into what he's trying to say. And with him, he's being hard on you because he sees the potential that you have. And with him, he's not going to sugarcoat anything. If you're wrong, he's going to tell you you're wrong and help you fix it. But at the end of the day, he loves his players, loves his organization, and he wants all of his guys to succeed as well as get his degree.
Listen, he very clearly, he loved you when he saw something in you. I've got about a minute. Are you and I having this conversation today about you being a Super Bowl champ if you did not go through what you went through with Coach Hagans in the early years?
Honestly, if I didn't go through the stuff with Coach Hagans, I don't know if I would be the same person because he's been a big influence on my life, regardless of football, just life in general. A lot of lessons he's helped me learn, a lot of advice that he's given me. Just life itself, he really helped me out a lot, being a great role model. And just with the football aspect, he really his resume shows he produces really dominant defensive linemen. And just being part of that resume, that's an honor.
We're talking more about the NBA trade deadline. I mentioned at the very top that generally the in-season NBA trade deadline is not all that dope. Given that it's not all that dope, I've got a lot of reaction and a lot of takes, which is fun. The deadline came and went yesterday at 3 p.m. So what that meant was you had a handful of guys cleaning out their lockers and reaching out to real estate agents. Part of the business, on paper, we get to sit here and break down the transactions. We analyze it. But in reality, a bunch of guys have the logistical nightmare of having to navigate a change of scenery, a change of neighborhoods, state, schools, the whole thing, and do it right in the middle of the season. We never really talk about that. We don't concern ourselves with that, but guys have to do it. I mean, think about what a pain in the ass it is to move. And then think about what a pain in the ass it is to move when you know you're going to move, like it was your decision, you planned it. Imagine having to move at the drop of a dime because you got fired, or in this case, traded. It's hard. Sometimes it's for the better and sometimes it's not. Take Andre Drummond. He's one of the guys who had to move or will have to move. And let's just say that he's not all that happy about it. Let's just say that when he found out, he did not exactly fold his tent quietly in Detroit. You know that whole rap about it not being personal? That whole rap about it's just business, it's not personal? Yeah, well, Drummond is calling bullcrap on all of that. He tweeted, quote, "If there's one thing I've learned about the NBA, there is no friends or loyalty. I've given my heart and soul to the Pistons, and to have this happen with no heads up makes me realize even more that this is just a business," end quote. Right. They're just saying it. It's just business. It's just business. He then chased that with a photo of him holding his son, and he wrote, quote, "Remember, son, trust no one," end quote. It's a hell of a message to pass down to your kid. Trust no one. My man, I know it's disappointing. I know you liked it there. I know you had roots there. You got traded. It happens. It happens almost to everybody. You're a good player. It happens to players even better than you, much better than you. It is business. In business, people get fired. People get traded. Now, in his defense, he clearly did want to stay in the D, which I give him credit for. I'm not saying that you wouldn't want to stay there. I'm saying he wanted to stay there. And it was very personal to him. But it does set up an interesting argument. Now, I want to be very clear about this. I do not have a dog in this fight. Actually, I don't have a dog in the fight. I have both dogs in the fight. Like, it's really convenient and really lazy to smash both the cities of Detroit and Cleveland, usually done by dopes who've never been to either city. I've been to both. I've had great experiences in both. I'm not pandering. I'm not just doing that for effect. I'm not saying it to try to get on their good side. I have been to Detroit. I have been to Cleveland multiple times. So I am not participating in this crap. However, the fact that Drummond is so pissed about being shipped out of Detroit to Cleveland only adds to the discussion that some of you are having about which city is worse. I'm not here for it. I'm not here to moderate that discussion. Again, I love both towns. A lot of heart, a lot of character. Great sports towns. Yeah, I said it, and I mean it. But many of you are having the best time ever killing Detroit and Cleveland. Talking about, man, you know why this guy's so pissed? Not that he wants to be in Detroit. He doesn't want to go to Cleveland, which is not true. He wants to be in Detroit. However, a lot of you are going to do what you're going to do. And there seems to be this punchline about a guy who'd rather stay in Detroit than get shipped to Cleveland. Like, on the one hand, people are rushing in to reset Joe Noah's classic line about Cleveland as evidence of that.
Do you like it? You think Cleveland's cool? I mean, I never heard anybody say, I'm going to Cleveland on vacation. What's so good about Cleveland?
Actually, Joe, a lot of things. But that was Joe Noah. The most famous Cleveland clapback to that Joe Noah blast comes from the final line of a Cleveland parody song, which has been viewed over 13 million times on YouTube.
Come on down to Cleveland Town, everyone. Under construction since 1868. See our river that catches on fire. We see the sun almost three times a year. This guy has at least two DUIs. It could be worse, though. At least we're not Detroit.
So you know there's a rivalry when the people of Cleveland are literally singing, it could be worse, though at least we're not Detroit.
We're not Detroit!
Again, this is not about the cities or their reps. It's about a two-time All-Star drafted by the Pistons who's got family in Detroit, clearly want to be on that team for the foreseeable future. And he was on the business end of a deal that felt very personal to him, and he let everybody know about it. On the opposite side of the spectrum, quickly, you've got the guys who thought they might be on the move, who found out they were staying yesterday, and they're hyped. Enter Boston Celtics big man, Enes Kanter. This dude's been playing on his fifth team since 2011. He understands the business. Nobody understands it better than Kanter. When he first got to the Celtics this year, the first thing he did was troll Kyrie Irving, making fun of him for saying that nobody would ever wear number 11 for the Celtics again after he was done there. That aged pretty well, because after Kyrie was bounced, Kanter put on number 11, made fun of Kyrie, and then told fans not to burn Kyrie's jersey because he is against wastefulness. He then told Celtics honks, man, just duct tape over Kyrie's name and write Kanter on the back. I mean, my man's a treasure. Yesterday, he filmed himself watching a digital clock tick down the final 5 seconds to the 3 p.m. Eastern deadline. And when he made it safely to the other side without getting dealt, he ran out onto the practice court and did snow angels on the logo.
Don't click out of it. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Woo! Let's go! Thank you, Celtics. Let's go!
And it's the menace. This guy's so good. He counted down from 5 to 0 and ran out onto the practice floor and did snow angels on the logo. That's a guy who wanted to be there. Never mind Kyrie. They should retire his number 11 based on that reaction. Kanter's. And remember, this guy was a Knick last season. So this dude went through some trauma. And I'm not totally sure that he wasn't just losing his mind, realizing that he didn't have to go back to Jimmy D's squad. Whatever the reason, he's stoked. Drummond is not. It is a business. And depending on who you were yesterday, it can be a great business or it can be a terrible one. Speaking of which, pour one out for Maurice Harkless. He went from a 15-loss Clippers squad to a 16-win Knicks squad. Enjoy that unplugged acoustic guitar on the team playing, Mo.
Wash away my troubles. Wash away my pain. With the rain and shambala.
wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame with the rain.
Hey, does this charter come with noise counseling headphones? Can I get a pair up here? Yo, bro, you want to get off that team? Go to Jimmy right now and tell him to sell the team. That'll get you kicked off that charter. That'll get you kicked off the team. Every time somebody says it in his building, he gets them kicked out. Just do it. Go to the owner. Sell the team. Sell the team. When Dolan comes to you and says, yo, Mo, welcome to the team. Go, yeah. Yeah, Dolan, sell the team. Ariel Helwani joins us. Ariel, what's going on? How are you?
Jim, good to talk to you again. You say friend of the program, but quite frankly, I thought I bothered you. You know, it's been so long since we last spoke. You were giving me the old stiff arm. It's nice to be back.
Never, ever. Not true. All good. You know that's not so. Ariel,
good to have
you.
I'm just joking.
Yeah, I know you are. And you are a good friend of the program. All right, so we're over 24 hours away now. Just 24 hours away from John Jones and Dominic Reyes at UFC 247 tomorrow night in Houston. Of late, with a John Jones fight, it feels like there are two storylines, right? There's John Jones versus his opponent, and then there's just John Jones, or maybe John Jones versus himself. 9 years ago this week, you spoke to him about getting his first title shot. What was he like to talk to at that point?
Oh, wow. Feels like a lifetime ago. I mean, he was just so wide-eyed. He was just a kid. He was just 23, and the circumstances surrounding that particular fight were fascinating because he was fighting an undefeated guy in Ryan Bader. And that morning, I recall, this was UFC 126, February of 2011, I recall started to be rumors that Rashad Evans, who was going to fight Shogun Hua in March for the light heavyweight title, was injured and that he would have to pull out of the fight. And at the time, John and Rashad were friends and training partners. And so he beats Ryan Bader. John Jones beats Ryan Bader. And then in the cage, Joe Rogan tells the world and tells John that the UFC wants to give him a title shot in 6 weeks against Shogun. He gets down on his knees and he's very emotional. And it seemed like we were about to witness something really special, this 23-year-old kid, the youngest champion eventually in UFC history. And of course, since then, 9 years, he's had many ups and downs, a lot of self-inflicted wounds, a lot of legal troubles. But here he is still on top, still the man, and in many people's eyes, still the greatest. It's pretty amazing to think that, you know, 9 years later, he's still the king. So another you know, big fight for him. You know, he can make history on Saturday. If he wins, he will have the most victories in UFC title fights, 14. He's currently tied with GSP at 13, so it's a big night for him.
Ariel Helwani joining us. I mean, that seems like a lifetime ago, and you're right. He's still on top even now at 32. Now, today he seemed pretty chipper at the weigh-in. He was chatting. He was posing for photographers. You did spend some time with him recently. How would you describe where he is at this point in his life, and how different is this John Jones from the one you spoke to 9 years ago?
Yeah, so he really is in good spirits, and his weight cut was very easy. He got to Houston on Tuesday 7 pounds lighter than he usually arrives for fight week. His manager told me today that it was one of the easiest, quote-unquote, weight cuts of his career. So you saw that a bit on the stage. You know, when he weighed in, he was in a very good mood, as you noted. And I think what he's starting to realize is these fights are good and all, and he's making good money, and, you know, he's performing relatively well in the fights. But I think he's starting to realize that in order to be considered one of the legends of mixed martial arts, he has to maybe test himself a little bit. And his last two fights weren't the most exciting fights. And, in fact, in his last fight at the end against Thiago Santos in July, he was booed. Fans didn't feel like he went for it, like he had a killer instinct. So for the first time, we're starting to hear him really talk seriously about moving up to heavyweight, and in particular, talking about the heavyweight champion, Stipe Miocic. And I think he's starting to realize he needs to get out of his comfort zone a little bit. So I don't necessarily think the next fight is against Stipe or even at heavyweight. I think he'll fight at least one more time at 205. But I think it would be a disappointing year for John and his fans if he doesn't fight at least once at heavyweight by the end of 2020. So he has lofty aspirations, heavyweight, potential fight against Israel Adesanya, who's a rising star at 185, but he has to get by Dominic Reyes first. If he doesn't, all that goes up in smoke.
Ariel Helwani joining us. All right, so what about Adesanya? He's fighting at UFC 248 in a month. He's made no secret of the fact that he wants to beat John Jones. He called Jones, quote, a washed-up old man. What's your sense of what Jones thinks of him deep down, and is that a fight that you could see happening soon, or is that going to have to wait? Like, where would that stand?
So I don't think it would happen this year. I think if they both continue to win, 2021 is a solid bet. I have to be honest, that's my favorite feud in MMA right now. And I was just kind of debating with my colleagues earlier today about which fight we would rather see, which dream fight, if you will, for John in the near future, the Stipe fight at heavyweight or the Izzy fight at 205 if Izzy comes up from 185. I picked the Izzy fight because the build-up to that fight would be so much fun. The back and forth between them is tremendous. Izzy really gets under his skin. And when I sat down with John last week, he's like, I'm kind of mad that you brought him up. I shouldn't be giving him this shine. And that to me, you know, makes me think that, like, you know, he understands that this is a big deal. This is a big fight. And he doesn't want to kind of put him over, to steal a pro wrestling phrase. But they have a really special relationship, and they seem to know how to push each other's buttons. And I would just love to see it. And I think stylistically, it would be a really fun fight as well. And so I don't think right now the UFC has this particular fight in their plans. I think there's a better chance of Jones fighting at heavyweight in 2020 rather than fighting Izzy. But if we don't see this fight by the end of 2021, and Izzy has said he would like for the fight to happen at the new Raiders Stadium in Las Vegas, which would be incredible, I would be disappointed, because I just think the buildup would be fun. If they're both undefeated up until this point, it would be tremendous. I mean, just the whole scene, the whole buzz would be tremendous. I would love to see it, and I think it would be a competitive fight as well.
Oh, I love it. I think Izzy is such a star. I think he's got star quality. I think he's got so much it. He's got unbelievable presence. Obviously, a great fighter. He's getting better. I would love to see that. Now, you mentioned Jones and Stipe. Should that go down, how do you think that fight would go?
I think Jones would look very good in that fight. I think at heavyweight, John Jones will be very dangerous if he does, in fact, move up. Because I think he would fight at around 230, 240. But he's a very lean 230, 240. I mean, 6'4", longest reach. We know how he looks. And I just think that a lot of the heavyweights would have trouble with his reach, with his boxing, with his speed as well. I think he'd be a lot faster. I mean, even Daniel Cormier is a lot faster than a lot of the heavyweights, you know, coming up from 205. And he, of course, doesn't have the same build as John. So I would favor John in that fight. The one thing that John has never had is knockout power, so I don't think his power, quote unquote, would translate as a heavyweight. But another thing about John is he always seems to rise to the occasion when the stakes are the highest. And I think one of the knocks on him has been that maybe sometimes he fights down to his competition. When he's fighting guys who people may perceive to be lesser competition, he doesn't seem to be as motivated. I think he would be supremely motivated to fight someone like Stipe to try to make history and be, you know, just the second man to be the light heavyweight and heavyweight champion.
Ariel Helwani joining us. I would imagine, Ariel, if Dominic Reyes were listening to this right now, he'd be like, yeah, you guys are going to get around to talking to me at any point.
Yeah,
there is
right?
a fight coming up. What about Reyes? Reyes is really a fascinating case. He was, only 2 years ago, he was a high school IT guy. How do you explain him fighting for a belt tomorrow night?
Well, it's a little bit of two things. Number one, he's really good. He's undefeated. He's a rising star. But he's just 12-0. And to your point, high school IT guy, he is a good athlete, former DB at Stony Brook University. Shout out to Long Island. I mean, he's a guy who obviously has earned everything that he's been given. But this is kind of, you know, this is kind of an example of John Jones has been good for a very long time. He's been good for 9 years. And when you're good for that long and you're as active as he's been, especially as of late, this is, you know, his third fight in a little over a year, you're going to run out of opponents. You're going to run out of competition. So if it was up to me, perfect world, I'd prefer if Dominic had one or two more fights. Fighting John Jones is a hell of a lot different than fighting some of the other guys he's fought as of late. And I'm not trying to take anything away from them. He's just that darn good. But as a result of the fact that there just isn't a lot of names left that John hasn't fought, they have to push someone like Dominic a little quick. And so that's what I'm curious about tomorrow. Is he going to fight down to the competition? Is he motivated? Is he looking past Dominic Reyes? These are the things that we're thinking about with Jones right now, because he has done so much, accomplished so much, and because he's looked so good. You have to try to find these little storylines to wonder about before his fights, because on paper, stylistically and athletically, I don't think a lot of these guys stack up to him.
Now, really quickly, when you spoke to Reyes back in October, he told you, I see the path. I'm going to knock him out. Lots of guys have talked about beating Jones. Jones has never really been stopped. Can Reyes cause problems for Jones, and what would his path for victory be?
Yes, he can. He is long as well. He is tall. There is a theory out there that John has trouble against tall guys. He's 6'4" as well. The one thing he does have that's very interesting to me is he has power. He's a very strong guy. And some people believe that John doesn't like to get hit. Now, it's very hard to hit John because of his reach. He's able to fight, you know, at a distance. But what if he tags him, especially early? What if he gets in his head a little bit, the same way Alexander Gustafsson did back in 2015, my favorite fight of all time? Gustafsson caught him early in the first round, and it took John a little while to get back on his feet, you know, and to get his groove again. So I think it's imperative that Reyes tries to make a statement very early, tries to let John know that he is here, that he is powerful, that he can catch him, that he can close that distance. And then, you know, if he's able to do that early on, all bets are off. You know, in 2007, April of 2007, here in Houston, we saw arguably the greatest upset in UFC history. Matt Serra knocking out George St. Pierre. That was their first trip to H-Town. Here we are 13 years later. We may see the second one if he's able to do it.
Ariel Helwani joining me for another couple of moments. All right, really quickly, in the co-main event, Valentina Shevchenko is defending her flyweight belt. There's been a running joke among some fans that she might be a spy. She told you that she's not a spy, but as you point out, she would say that even if she were a spy. Leaving aside the possibility of espionage, what is she like as a fighter, and how do you like that matchup?
You know, she told me she's not a spy, but she says she's very excited about the Leon Rose hiring for the Knicks. I just had to throw that in there. Mark Morris deal was great. Anyway, she, in my opinion, is one of my favorite fighters to watch. Pound for pound, one of the best fighters on the planet, in my opinion, regardless of gender. She is so focused. You know, everything I was talking about Jones, like, you know, fighting down to your competition and not being motivated, all that stuff. She has that problem even more so in the sense that she is so much better than the rest of the weight class. I would argue that the gap between her and the rest of the 125-pounders is larger than any gap that we've ever seen between champion and contenders. But the difference between her and Jones is she never loses focus. She is stoic. She is so darn laser-focused. It's amazing. Always in supreme shape, always on point, always ready to go. It's just a joy to watch her fight because she's such a professional. And technically, she is just so amazing as well. So I don't think Caitlin has much for her to offer. Again, anything can happen when you're fighting with 4-ounce gloves. But Valentina, in my opinion, is one of the best fighters on the planet. And anytime we get to watch her fight, it's a treat.
You know, got to get your thoughts on this. One last thought. I've been spending a lot of time lately with Jorge Masvidal. He came on this show. He came on our podcast. I saw him in Miami. I love the guy. I love him personally. I love him professionally. What do you think is next for him, and what's your take on him?
I think it will be that fight, International Fight Week. That would be July 11th off the top of my head in Las Vegas against Kamaru Usman for the welterweight title. Jorge Masvidal is one of the best stories that I've ever come across covering this sport. Here's a guy who's in his 17th year professionally. Jim, you've been covering sports for a lifetime. You don't see guys in year 16 and 17 come into their prime. You don't see guys in year 16 and 17 enjoy the success and the notoriety. He was kind of, you know, middle tier sort of journeyman-esque fighter, if you will. And then last year, he explodes. He's the first product of the ESPN era. And what I mean by that is he has peaked at the time that ESPN finally started to pay attention to the sport and put it on SportsCenter and stuff like that. And so when he knocked out Ben Askren in that amazing fashion back in July, he was all over SportsCenter. Everyone's talking about him, and now he's become this amazing superstar. No one saw this coming. I didn't see this coming. No one around him saw this coming, and he's really running with that ball. So finally, after all these years, it looks like he's on the verge of getting a title shot. And could you imagine if he wins that fight against Kamaru Usman, and maybe Conor wins his next fight, a title fight between Jorge Masvidal and Conor McGregor would be one of the biggest fights in UFC history. Some people wanted it next. It looks like they're going to go in a different direction, but I couldn't be happier for Jorge. Truly one of the good guys in the sport, and he deserves all of this.
Yes, I agree. I love him. That'd be an amazing thing. He is a journalist for ESPN. He is the host of Ariel Helwani's MMA show, Ariel and the Bad Guy, and the MMA Reporters, and you've got UFC 247 about 24 hours away, and he broke it all down. Ariel, great job. Appreciate you. Appreciate the conversation. Have a great weekend.
Anytime, guys. Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Alvy, are you ready? Do we have time? Roll it.
World champions, you gotta fight for your right to party!
Back home. Let's crack in. Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome.
Yeah, back in my studio.
Yeah.
Had a great time in Miami. We lay it out for you. KC fan. You know what you got to do? 50 years in the waiting. Another come-from-behind victory on the biggest stage of all. Does it feel the way you thought that it would feel?
Yeah! Kansas City Chiefs are champions.
How about those Chiefs? How about Andy Reid?
That's better with my trophy wife. How's that?
That a boy. Big Reid.
He winds up, he throws a long pass, wide open hill, catches the ball.
Going to go down in history, 2-3, Jet Ship Wasp.
What a play by Mahomes.
Big brass set. Jim Trotter joining us. But does it feel like this might be the start of something really special with Mahomes?
Oh, without question. I mean, think about it, Jim. I keep coming back to that word special, and this kid is it in every way.
Chiefs fans, get up in here. What do you waiting on?
All the rest of you in Kansas City, y'all can hang up. I got
this. Super Bowl 54 halftime show.
As long as the Red Hot Chili Peppers aren't out there going all league family, I'm fine with it.
Twitter.
66-year-old Jeb Bush. Best Super Bowl halftime show ever. 15 yards for, quote, excessive horniness.
Can't control my horny level.
Led Zeppelin riff.
Brian McFadden.
Hey, Matt, were you late?
I'm like, yeah, coach, I was late.
You know what? I'm taking all your tickets. You have no Super Bowl tickets, man. My heart dropped. I was like, what? B-Mac, I'm just joking with you. Enjoy yourself.
Kevin Harlan.
Jim, I've listened to you for so long. It's surreal that I'm even talking to you, but it's great to be on. Thank you for having me.
The guy is drunk, but there he goes.
Cannot believe no one is going out there and chasing after this guy.
Exactly. Where is Mike Curtis when you need him?
Exactly right. Or Bednar.
They say all good things must come to an end.
Did you see that cryptic post? Is he coming? Is he going? What's it all mean? What's it all mean is you're a bunch of dopes. Worst troll job ever. Jared in Maine.
Mookie Betts is going to L.A. now? And I am a diehard.
My man, did you just belch in the middle of a call? Do I have to establish a no belching rule? Yeah, by the way, I had a moment at Radio Row where Dan Marino veered off path to come over and say, what's up, Jim?
Dan Marino.
Anyway.
You know that that balloon head owner was spouting off a bunch of canal water. Yes. And...
Hey, my man, you can't trust a stripper, Van Smack. Who can you trust? It's not like we're talking about a team that's been bad for a long, long time that has no choice but to take a wrecking ball to it. This is a team that won it all less than 2 years ago. Now they're breaking it all up and giving up on bets. I did it all for the Mookie.
Come on.
For the Mookie.
Come on.
So you can stick Mookie. And stick it up your yeah. Stick it up your yeah. Signed, Andrew Friedman.
Andrew.
John Morosi. What are they about to see now that he's a member of the Dodgers?
A superstar. A dynamic superstar. One of the most electrifying players ever to put on a Dodger uniform.
Like, I don't want to kill a song. You ever do that too? Like, you have a song you like, but you keep hitting it over and over and over again. And then even if you put it aside for like a year, you've already wrecked it. That's that song to me. Alvin, don't wreck it.
But, you know, in all seriousness.
Marcus Williams, my guest.
Shoot. I mean, Alvin has some good style. He comes with a different type of style every time.
24-0! I ain't trying to hear!
That's what you go to a victory parade for. To throw back a few, scream. Travis Kelce truly is a national treasure. Steve Atwater, my guest. That lick that you laid on Christian Okoye.
I never imagined that it would people still be talking about it to this day. What, 30 years later now?
But I got Triple U for you.
It's not the Triple U segment. Oh, it's the beef segment.
Bringing my hose to your filth, and I'm sliding across your lawn and dog crap.
My dog to my yard, and I'll crap in it if I want. You got that, John?
Edgerrin James. Peyton say that you're his favorite teammate ever.
And that's my boy, man. P's my boy. You know, we grew together, you know?
Can't wait to inhale that and then promptly excrete it through my O-ring. Woo!
Every time you call in with something stupid,
excrete it through my O-ring.
I'm flying down, swooping down, and drop kicking you straight in the throat.
Well, let me say it again for the last time today. The cover-up is always worse than the crime, JJ.
JJ!
Calais Campbell, how are you?
Oh, man, life is a dream, baby. Living it up.
First team to play back-to-back games in London next season.
You know, I mean, it's football. You put me anywhere, let me go play the game of love. I'm going to do it the best I can.
Derek Nottie joining us. All of the dogs have been adopted. What does it mean to you to hear that?
It's amazing. It's really magical. Like, in there, now they're finally in the forever homes with families that are going to love and cherish them.
Hello, David Feldman.
Feldman, it's Romy.
That guy's more obsessed with wrestling than, like, JC's roommate.
With a guy.
Oh, my God!
Jim Rome went on his show, and he said, now settle down.
Thanks so much, Jim. Really love your show, too, man.
Diabetes.
This is why we do sports.
Lombardi.
Play the game with athletic arrogance.
This is better than the halftime show.
Stop with that bass, man.
We're not Detroit.
Again, thank you.
I love you.
Good night now. Good night now.